No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, retired as of Tuesday, coming to you live from the District of Columbia. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important and affect the lives of all of us. And tonight we have a very special guest, Marianne Williamson. Marianne Williamson ran for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States in 2024 and 2020. In 2014, she ran for a House for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives from California, and now she's running for chair of the Democratic National Committee. We all know who she is. She's a successful entrepreneur, best-selling author, political activist, global influencer, spiritual thought leader, and for more than three decades, she has been a leader in spiritual and progressive circles and is the author of an unbelievable 15 books, four of which have been number one New York Times bestsellers, and she's with us tonight. And thank you so much for being here, Marianne. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you, to be on the phone with you, and thank you for having me, Michael.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we just start at the top before we get into all this stuff with you? What do you think about the election? What about Donald Trump? I don't want to take up the whole show talking about this, but I'd like your impressions. I know that as somebody that's been involved in Democratic politics for 40 years, including being a DNC staffer for many years and having this be my 13th consecutive Democratic convention, I was shocked. I was shocked that he won.
I wasn't shocked.
What are your feelings?
I wasn't shocked this time, just like I wasn't shocked in 2016. During my campaign for president this year, I remember saying repeatedly that I felt that this campaign was going to be more like 2016 than like 2020. I was in 16 and this time. I was as horrified as everybody I knew, but I wasn't as shocked as some people I knew. Yeah. I had seen in 2016 how much anger was out there that was unaddressed with a message like, let's just continue the success of the last 8 years, when I knew how many millions of people were out there going, what success, lady? I'm drowning here. This time, it wasn't like I registered in very extensive travel that I do. It wasn't so much that I registered so much anger. I registered something almost more toxic for the public domain, and that is despair. I just giving up, hopelessness. A sense that what does it matter anyway? And I thought, wow, that nihilism, Trump is tapping into it, and Democrats certainly aren't. So I feel that for decades now, the Democrats have been building a big hole, and Donald Trump simply walked into it. If it hadn't been Donald Trump, it would have been someone. You know, one of my one of the lines from Roosevelt that has always meant a lot to me, he said, we don't have to worry about a fascist takeover in this country as long as democracy delivers on its promises. And that's the real problem here, Michael. You know, we're complaining about the thief, but we left windows open. We left doors open. When we're the only advanced nation in the world without health care, when we used to have tuition-free and near-tuition-free college and tech school situations until the 60s, but we don't have them anymore. When there's been a $50 trillion transfer of wealth from the bottom 90% of the American people over the last 50 years, completely decimating our middle class. And by the way, let's be honest with ourselves. The Republicans started this, but the Democrats have not stopped it. And so this idea, you know, I think sometimes also people spend so much time and energy hating on Trump that we don't spend enough time observing him. How did they do this? That's what we have to ask ourselves. How did they create this 21st century political phenomenon? If when you do start thinking that way, and when you start looking closely at the DNC, you realize that we're playing with a 20th century playbook. What do you expect? If you've got a 20th century playbook and you do business kind of like it's maybe 2004, 2008, and this juggernaut's coming at you with this decidedly 21st century tenor to it, and you're going to keep playing a playbook that is so failed, then once again, if we don't decide to make fundamental changes in ourselves, you know, if we really want a different government, a different House, a different Senate, and a different president in the future, we're going to have to be a different Democratic Party.
Well, I agree with that. And do you think that you have more of a sense of this because Democrats have become so insular? I mean, you're out there moving around the country. It's funny. The one thing that I got that disturbed me was when I went out to Nebraska and talked before the United States, before the Nebraska Senate a few months ago. And I got a lot of the feedback that you're giving right now from people in Nebraska. And I said, whoa, you know, is that part of our problem that we've become insular? We're now New York, Washington, and L.A., and we're not the rest of the country? Do you think that plays really into it on the Democratic side? We just don't understand anymore?
On levels that are so extreme and so malfunctional. It's interesting that you mentioned Nebraska. There are a lot of Democrats in Nebraska.
Yeah, there are.
But you wouldn't know it. But you might not know it, would you? Do you know how much money is given to the Nebraska Democratic Party by the DNC? Hardly any. So the money is funneled by a consultant into a consultancy class. And this consultancy class, it's all about that consultancy class. Now, a consultant on K Street knows very little about Nebraska and knows very little about how to talk to Nebraskans and knows very little about what the issues are that Nebraskans are facing. Meanwhile, you have people in the Democratic Party there who do know, some of whom are, these are wonderful people out there. That's what I've been experiencing over the last week. There are wonderful people out there. There's wonderful talent. Nebraska is actually an example, as is Kansas, as in North Dakota, as are so many of these states, where the consistent message is we would know what to do. Not only is the money not funneled to them, not only is does the DNC operate in a way that is very miserly, just a little bit here and a little bit there. They have to beg for $2,500. Meanwhile, these are hundreds of millions of dollars, literally, that are being spent on these consultant contracts, right? And the states out there, Nebraska being a perfect example, are so excited when they can get $3,000 for signage. Now, let's look at what this has done. This has taken us from a place where, as we know, so many of these things have become red states. It's worse than that they've become red states. They've become red supermajorities. And in so many cases, the state party people have said to me, it did not have to get this bad. It did not have to get this bad. But I think a lot of people think of the Democratic National Committee as a kind of central intelligence, It's almost like the DNC should be a kind of central banking service to send money out to the states, and instead they look to the states to get money for them. It's extraordinary how much fundraising these states are expected to do and then to send their money to the DNC. So many of the things that happen. So when you said just now you met people in Nebraska, I'm curious, when you were saying you were getting this feedback, were you getting it from Republicans or you were getting it from Democrats?
Well, I think I was getting it from most people that I was meeting casually. I met a bunch of veterans, for example, that were at the same hearing that I was at, and they stood up for me because of the veterans in the District of Columbia who do not have the same rights everybody else has. But they also complained to me about some of the same things you're saying. And I should tell you, when I was at the DNC, I was a fundraiser, and this is and the scenario you're talking about is exactly the way we did it 40 years ago. I actually ran a thing for the state parties to give money to the state parties, and there were state parties that didn't want to take it because they were so I don't know, suspicious of DNC motives. They had gotten so little money from the DNC. We used to, I was a direct mail person, and we were going to filter money. We did through a thing called the state party program. And there were some people that didn't even want to participate because they were so suspicious that the DNC would do anything for them. It was just really, really eye-opening in those days. You know,
that's
and
how
I know
I feel, Michael. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably still true. You know,
not only is it so true, but people who are in the party, members of the party, even not coming from a position of just wanting their states to get more, but from a position of what is going on here? What is going on here? And more people are, you know, there's some, once again, lovely people that I've met. People, someone in Nebraska knows how to talk to people in Nebraska. People in Kansas know how to talk to people in Kansas. And there is an increasing, like you said, there's a real suspicion of what the hell is going on here. And I feel my candidacy is in many ways a voice for those who have clearly figured it out. Something doesn't smell right here because it's not right.
Well, and that's something that really inspired me about you, Marianne, is that you said earlier when we talked prior to you being on the show, to get you on the show, you said, well, we have to, you know, no matter what the odds are, we have to be out there fighting the good fight, right? And I believe that. I say that all the time about statehood. We can't accept sitting on the back of the bus. Even if we don't get anywhere, we still got to stand up, right? And you're an important voice. And that's why we want to give you a forum, and I hope lots of people will give you a forum, because a lot of the things you're saying, Marianne, are so, so true. Let me ask you, are you getting any support from DNC members who are the people that have to vote for you?
You know, Michael, I lost you for a minute there. Will you say your last sentence again?
Yeah. Are you getting any support from DNC members, the people that actually have to vote for the chairmanship?
Okay. Well, the first process, as you, I'm sure you know because you worked there, is getting 40 signatures to get on the ballot. So we got 42 by the time we stopped. So that was a week's process because I got in very late. And during that week, I was on the phone all day. Now, there are establishment forces who clearly had told people, don't pick up the phone. Don't answer her phone call. Don't answer her text. I mean, you could almost feel the resistance, much like I had felt when I was a candidate. So much of what I'm experiencing now is exactly the same template and pattern that I felt as a candidate. But then some people picked up the phone, or some people clearly just know what's going on over there. And among the people who were so gracious and so kind and did sign my petition, did include people from Washington, D.C., I'm very grateful to say, those people know the score. At a certain point, it's obvious what's going on here. So the DNC membership is like the rest of the world. There's a huge shift going on, and a kind of old guard establishment way of doing things is trying to hold on very hard. And then there are people who realize at this point, given the electoral catastrophe of 2024, it's no longer we really should go in a different direction. We must go in a different direction if the party's even to survive as a relevant political entity. And I think we need to remember we have the fate of our country in our hands here.
Yeah, I don't know how it can be any more obvious, Marianne, when you've got a guy that's out there saying they're eating your cats and dogs, and and we're turning over the nuclear codes to this man. You know, I mean, that's the thing that shocked me, is that they were out there saying these such outrageous things that anybody with you know, an IQ above 90 would realize are ridiculous, and he still won. He still won in the
I think it's a default for Democrats to go into about how outrageous he is. I would also propose that it is equally outrageous that we have been so inept at countering that. So that's what I'm concentrated on. I don't want to spend all my time and energy at this point thinking about what he's doing. I want to repair the broken system by which Democrats are not countering him. And, you know, one of the things I've noticed, I think this is relevant, Michael. In the Republican Party, a lot of people come from the private sector, much more than in the Democratic Party. So in the among the people in the private sector, this is what they know. If things aren't working on Tuesday, then you better fix them by Thursday. And if you don't, your business might go under on Saturday. So the Republicans are capable of a very quick pivot. The Democrats work the opposite. This is our playbook, and we're sticking with it. So if the business isn't working on Tuesday, we're not going to change anything. And even if people are yelling loud, we're going to go under on Saturday. They act like they're the grown-ups. We got this. It's under control, even though it's not. Then even if on Saturday you can look at those people and go, you don't got this. You just lost Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Ohio. They still want to hold on Monday to what they did before, which really makes you think about it, Michael, because the point is that they're making the same money whether we win or we lose.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, first of all, I've got to say, you know, it's funny that you're bringing, I brought up Nebraska and that key, you know, got you to think of something. And what you just said, I have something over my desk, Marianne, that's been over there since I had my own business for 25 years. And it was from a Chicago economist that said, in the long run, we're all dead, which is the mantra of business, right? It's like, right, you can't. You're not worried if you're not Walmart or Amazon. You're not worried about what you're doing next year. You're just worried about what's happening next week and what you know and how you're going to pay your payroll and how you're going to do the next thing. And I think the Democrats have forgotten that. It's just incredible to me. I noticed that on an interview you said we need to produce our own magic. So how do we do that to counter what this man who is really a charlatan? My father, Marianne, was a con man. He was just like Donald Trump, but he was small time, nickel and dime kind of guy. And I see so much of my dad in this guy every time he opens his mouth. And he definitely is a con man, and we've been conned. So, you know, I'm a former Teamster too, Marianne. So I couldn't believe that the head of the Teamsters Union gave a speech at the Republican National Convention in between Hulk Hogan and whoever the hell else was crazy enough to show up for that. So I agree with everything you say. But how do we move the Democratic Party?
Okay, so let's talk about how he creates that magic. First of all, he creates that magic with the charismatic force of his own personality, which is why I believe a charismatic voice at the helm of the DNC would be very helpful right now. But secondly, they really tend to their relationship with their base. They are on it 24/7, and they are in chat rooms and Facebook pages and Reddit and all these smaller podcasts. We have a bunch of people in the consultancy class in K Street. First of all, the template until now they're talking about doing it differently now going forward, but I don't really trust voices who it took until now to recognize what to me we should have been recognizing for years now. You know, people are saying, oh, well, I guess we should be talking to all 50 states and 7 territories. And I'm like, you think? Well, I guess we should have been talking to kitchen table issues. And I'm like, you think? But the point is, how did they do it, and what do we need to do? Democrats have been in the habit of basically never talking to our people, except every 2 years. So every 2 years, we go out there and we say, please give us money, please give us your votes. And then it's almost as though, trust us, then we're going to go back into our wood-paneled rooms, and you're just supposed to assume that we're doing something good for you. Now, what do the Republicans do? So one of the things I've been talking about recently, Michael, is I often notice when I talk to my Republican friends, and I'll bring up an issue, and man, they're ready to engage. They know facts, figures, analysis, data. Yeah. I'm like, whoa, you know, you got that from something more than listening to Fox News. What, do you get Heritage Foundation talking points every day?
Sure.
And then I realize, no, they are in constant communication with their base, telling them about issues, telling them about what they are doing in the Senate, what they're doing in the House. And this is as true when they're not in power as when they are in power. So the Republicans don't walk their talk, but the Democrats don't talk our walk. So even when the Democrats are doing the right thing, we don't bother to inform the electorate that that's what we did. So one of the things I would do as chair is to create an infrastructure for communications, the likes of which does not currently exist. Now, remember, when we have the House, we have the microphone, the megaphone of the speaker. When we have the White House, obviously, you have the biggest megaphone in the world. When we have the Senate, that's a megaphone. Coming into this next session, we have nothing like that. So the Democratic National Committee must become that megaphone. And that's where I will come in. And I will come in with a dedication not only to communicating with our electorate every hour of every day, but also, excuse me, it's the 21st century. Have you seen how bad the DNC is at TikTok? Have you seen how silly it is on Instagram? And one of the things I noticed, the Democratic National Committee membership, there is so much talent there. We have the young people who, you know, it's like when you saw those pictures of Barron Trump telling his father what podcasts to go on to. We don't have to go hire some consultancy group on K Street. They wouldn't even know those podcasts. They don't even know them. But you know what? There are people in the orbit of the membership of the DNC that would. And that's why, for me, one of the biggest changes that would occur with me as leader is a democratization and diversification, not only sending money out, but also sharing power. They govern the DNC in exactly the way we say we don't believe in. It's an oligarchy of consultants, very top down, a very tight fist held on the power. Do you know the people in the budget committee? Zogby has talked about this for years. The people in the budget committee don't even know the budget. It's very opaque. It's not transparent. So, hello, if we want to save democracy, try practicing democracy. That's how we're going to do it.
Well,
we're not going to win. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
We're not going to win over the next 2 and 4 years just by fighting Donald Trump. We're going to win by inspiring the American people. And that is by 24/7 reminding the American people what this is even about, many of whom do not remember, either didn't learn quite what they should have learned in seventh grade civics class, or in too many cases learned it from a board tutor, or don't quite remember it, or never learned
it,
whatever
it was. Or they don't teach it anymore either.
That's right.
You know,
in many places they don't. That's right. So if you have young people who don't grow up learning about the Bill of Rights, how do we expect them to be horrified as adults when the Bill of Rights is under an assault, especially when your political opponents sure are hammering home about the Second Amendment, but nobody really went over with them the importance of the First and the Third and the Fourth and the 14th and the 23rd. So,
there's a huge
cultural shift.
And the shortest amendment, the Second Amendment, which none of them know. You know, they only know shall not be infringed. They don't know the beginning of the Second Amendment, which is a militia being important to security of the state. Yes, they forget that the Second Amendment was really put in there to protect the government, not to destroy the government. But anyway, it all these things you say resonate with me, Marianne, and I remember the last guy that tried to change this was a governor who came in and fired all the consultants at the DNC and tried to change things. Didn't happen. It's
who was
a Rory,
it?
Rory. Governor, New England governor, Howard Dean, who became chairman of the DNC.
What happened when he tried to do that, Michael?
Well, there was a big resistance. First of all, he did get rid of all the consultants. Even the good consultants. There were a handful of good consultants. Got rid of all of them. And he tried to restructure.
Yeah, there's some very good people in there as well. Yeah.
Right. But then they fell right back into the same kind of, the things that you're talking about that have led up to what the DNC is today. There's a lot of resistance to this. And also, Will Rogers said about the Democrats is true, right? That he belongs to no organized political movement. He's a Democrat. We fight with each other as much as we fight with the Republicans. And it's obvious that what you say about we're not going to win just by fighting Donald Trump, I mean, that should be obvious to everybody because that's what we did and we lost. We lost.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. The fight phase is over. We lost.
Yeah,
and we're not going to win by saying, oh, we're going to do the same thing we did before, but tweaking it here, tweaking it there, a little more bells and whistles over here, and some incremental change over there. It's the fight paradigm. It's like when you are flying and you're in turbulence, what we're going to do is fly above it.
Right.
We're going to fly above it. And that's how we are going to win. We're going to inspire people. Of what you said about, like when Will Rogers said, I'm not a part of an organized party. I'm a Democrat. When I was growing up and when you were growing up, we were the free thinkers. We were the cool people. We were the creative thinkers. One of the things I learned when I was running this time that was so, I couldn't even believe it, was how enthralled so many Democratic voters were to whatever the DNC said. For instance, the DNC saying we weren't going to have a primary. But one of the things it's been made very clear to me, I think the vast majority of voters of the members of the DNC, they didn't make that decision.
Right.
They didn't make that decision. Most of them, not talking, they didn't even know I was running or thought I was running as a third party. No, it's a small group of people who are the decision makers. But part of the problem is that we have allowed, and that would be part of the problem at this point, if the members continue to allow it. So when you're talking about the difference between when Howard Dean tried to make changes versus my trying to make changes, is the years that have occurred since then. And I don't know.
And he was an insider. He certainly, as a governor, was an insider as well.
But today, when you look at the map and see what's happened, and it's not even just the presidential. I also think the DNC has been far too focused on the presidential when we should be focused on it's a national conversation of saving democracy. They have not been willing to share resources with these state parties when it comes to these local elections, local initiatives, state initiatives, Senate races where, if you're going to stand for democratic values, stand for democratic values everywhere. Once again, what's the shift that might part the waters here? There are a lot of members who see it for what it is and have been dismissed and have been treated in condescending ways and patronizing ways. Don't you worry about it. We're the grown-ups. We're the sophisticated people. We have institutional memory, and we got this. It's time for an uprising among the membership of people who say, you know what, you don't got this. And you are a failed and you represent a failed and a failing playbook. And we are now going to own our power and change directions. And it has to be on that fundamental a level, or we will just continue our trajectory of decline. And that's when you have to really remind yourself what's at stake here, because a lot is at stake here.
A lot is at stake. And if the things you say had happened, I don't think we would have renominated the president. I love Joe Biden, but he wasn't the right candidate. And neither was Kamala Harris in the end. She was the only candidate I guess we could have with 10 weeks before the election. But, the insular nature of the Democratic Party, that really has to end. I agree with that 100%. I'm not sure exactly how we do it, but I want you to know, you've got at least one retired senator on your team. Anything I can do to help make that happen, because I really think that absolutely needs to happen. And we saw a transition with Bill Clinton. You know, when I was a consultant to the Democratic Party, when Bill Clinton came along, and we laughed at him. We called him the Republican Democrat, you know, because he was more conservative. He was with a group of people like Sam Nunn from Georgia, and they were kind of middle of the road Democrats. And we were all Dukakis Democrats and Carter Democrats, you know. But look at the change that he made in not only in the government and the Democratic Party, but for some reason we reverted back to the old Democratic Party, I think. So I really believe in what you're saying. I'm just not sure how we can make it happen. But as you said to me earlier, no matter if we make it happen or not, we got to be out there speaking truth to power. We've got to be pushing. We got to be trying to make it happen. So can we talk for a second? Oh, go ahead.
No, you go on.
No, I was just going to say, I worked on the Carter campaign, and I worked for the Carter Center, and I've been wrapped up the last few days with arrangements for President Carter's funeral. I'm going to his funeral on Thursday. I'm going to Andrews Air Force Base on Tuesday when they bring him to Washington. Can I have your impressions on Jimmy Carter? He was not a great president, but he is a great man. That's my impression.
Yeah, and I also think even as president, he probably deserves more credit than he got. I'm curious, Michael, about something you said a few minutes ago. When you said that you were talking about Bill Clinton and the changes that Bill Clinton brought in, and of course it was in the 1970s that the Democratic Party started taking corporate money. So that opened up a window of, let all the poison come in. But when you were talking about the changes that Clinton brought, and then you said we've reverted to the old, would you be a little more specific? Because I kind of lost your train of thought there. What was the old that we reverted to?
The idea that, one of the problems I think we have, the Achilles heel that the Democratic Party has, is we talk down to America. And when Clinton came in, there was an adjustment in the way we thought. For example, if you take welfare reform, Clinton worked on welfare reform, and that was a sacred cow inside the Democratic Party. You just didn't touch it. You just didn't touch any of the welfare programs. And he reformed welfare, and he brought, I think, the party around to the idea that, okay, you can have a big heart, and you can care about people, but you don't have to drink the Democratic Kool-Aid. You don't have to drink the DNC Kool-Aid. And I see that during this campaign, that we all thought, hey, man, all you have to do is stand behind Kamala Harris and we'll win. All you have to do is do what you're told to do and stand in line, just like the Republicans did, but we didn't have a message. Clinton had a message. So that's what I mean. I think we've reverted back to that.
Well, I think that, like when I said before, we used to be the free thinkers. I think that the way we just stand behind whatever the DNC had said was not healthy. And when you say it's what the Republicans do, I don't think it's necessarily what the Republicans do. I think those Republican a lot of people in the Republican Party hold their people to account. And unfortunately, at this point, holding them to account, it means making sure that they support their dear leader, Donald Trump. But I also think, isn't it ironic that when Clinton talked about welfare reform, I think it's what you and I would call the opposite of reform.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
he got rid of the Democratic sacred program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it became a party where, and this is like when Clinton used to say, I feel your pain, but he introduced an era of the Democratic Party trying to have it both ways. Yeah, we feel your pain. Yes. We want to make things better. But we're not going to go so far as to cross a line where it would offend our donors. And that's yes. how we appear to the American people, which is just you're a bunch of hypocrites. You say you're for, you know, you say you're for the people. Now, I don't know why, as you were saying before, I don't know why they're not registering the hypocrisy of Donald Trump. But Donald right. Trump has a way of, he's a better actor. He's better yes. at pretending that he cares. And
right. And, you know, we've always said, Marianne, when you campaign, I train people to campaign. You have to give people a reason to vote for you. You can't just say the other guy sucks. You know, I mean, it just doesn't work to say, yeah, he's no good. And that's why you want to vote for me, because I'm better than no good. And and I think that's what we said. And when you talk about being a free thinker, I think about the issue of abortion. The issue of abortion, which we hung our hat on as Democrats, my wife, who is the mother of three children, was offended as a woman by the Supreme Court decision. My daughters were offended by the Supreme Court decision. They're all college educated. But I don't know that a lot of women that voted for Trump really thought that abortion was an issue, was the end all be all issue. You know, that the Democrats tried to make it. They realized that in most states you can still get an abortion. That wasn't the issue to my wife and daughters. It was an intrusion on their personal right to have control over their own bodies. That was the issue to them. And I think the issue was different to a lot of women.
Well, I think a lot of women in the country bought Donald Trump's stuff when he said, I will protect you, and we're just going to send it back to the states, as though sending it back to the states was going to be all that they needed, and that, well, we can deal with that on the state level, which is erroneous, by the way. But that's what they thought. And also,
yeah, that's how we got segregation, right? Yeah.
Right. And I think also people are not stupid out there. And so when the Democrats are saying we're going to codify, well, how are you going to do that, especially given that you had all those times when you could have codified and you didn't? So by the time if Kamala had won, there would have been greater protection for women's reproductive rights and women's health. There's no doubt about it. But there's a level of compelling argument that we were not able to make, given that we could have done so much more earlier.
Right. And I think, and the point that I was trying to make is I think they assumed that that's all they had to say. They didn't need to explain it. They just needed to say that, and that women would accept it the way the college-educated women that I know accepted it. And I think they needed to explain that sending it back to the states was a horrible idea. And I don't think I don't ever think they really did that. So,
no.
Also they made right. We're still pretentious. We don't go on Joe Rogan. We don't let the team. We tell the Teamsters how many questions.
Was that unbelievable?
And how they can answer them. Yeah. How did that happen?
Yeah, I did. Well, you know, I did that endorsement meeting. It was a high point for me during the campaign. Okay. It was very exciting, sitting across from Sean O'Brien and his lawyer there, and all the members, and they're shooting those 16. Questions at you. It was fun. Meanwhile, like you said, he reported on Joe Rogan, and I also agree with you. How could you not go on Joe Rogan?
Yes.
But when he asked her three questions out of 16, and then one of her aides says, this will be the last question. What are you thinking? And then also, according to him, as she left the room, she turned around and said, we're going to win with or without you. Yeah, I'm sorry. Oh, that level of arrogance. Yeah. But this,
yeah,
is,
that's
this is what happens when you this is what happens when you take your base for granted. And people don't like that. Also, I have to tell you something. You said something earlier about how, well, we only had 10 weeks. You know, I was there, Michael. We could have done it. We could have had a blitz primary. And I
think now in retrospect, I think you're right.
Yeah. We could have done it. I was like ready to debate her, just like I'd been ready to debate Biden. So there were so many ruses. We don't primary sitting presidents. Well, who says? Eugene McCarthy primaried Lyndon Johnson. Robert Kennedy Sr. primaried Lyndon Johnson. Hello, we didn't think it was weird at the time. We just thought it was democracy. But all these
Democrats, my first job at the DNC, I have to put this in, Marianne, my first job at the DNC was making sure that Kennedy wasn't able to knock Carter out of the box. So he certainly put together an effort to get rid of Carter too. So
that was Teddy Kennedy, of course. Yeah. I think everyone has something to think about. I think everybody. I think that this is like when you were talking about how is the change going to be made at the DNC. The change is going to be made at the DNC if and when enough individual members of the DNC use their power in this election and say, you know what, I'm not going to go along. I'm not going to go along one more time with a system that has failed. Coming from people who, you know, there's quite a spectrum in terms of the people who are running. But if we're not standing for a genuine fundamental change in the culture of the organization, if we don't see the DNC as the megaphone for the articulation of the values and the ideals of the Democratic Party. You know, somebody said to me today, one of the state chairs said, well, you know, the Republicans don't care. And I said, well, you know, they don't care about process. But actually, part of their power, like when you said, how do we create magic? Part of the power of the Republican Party is that they have a cohesive worldview. It's a worldview that is horrifying to many of us, but it's a cohesive worldview. We don't articulate our worldview. You know, do you or do you not believe in progressive governance? Do you or do you not stand on the principles of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, and that everybody, whether they're gay, straight, black, Jewish, Arab, gay, trans, whatever they are, they deserve an equal shot here. That is our primary principle in the Declaration. It should be our primary principle as a party. Nobody even talks about it. We're all too cool to talk about the philosophical and moral ideals of the party. And that is what would be a very compelling clarion call to millions and millions of people. We're dry. We're technocratic. We come across, like at this point, bad businessmen. It's not even like we come across as a business. We come across as a business that doesn't even know how to survive. So mine would be a very different era, I can tell you that.
So is that what we really need to do? Do we need to start to replace the DNC? Is that where we should work? Should we work at the state level to elect people to become DNC members who are actually more in line with the ideals that you're putting out rather than just promoting the old guard? Is that really where the work in the field needs to be done?
Well, I think there are two issues here. On one hand, yes, part of the problem we have is so many people have just thrown up their hands and said to hell with it, with the Democratic Party. We do need more of those people. Don't go, run for the DNC. That's number one.
Right.
But there's also something else. And that's what's happening inside the hearts and minds of people who are in the party. There are some very, very good people who are in this party, very smart people.
I actually
think, Michael, I have a sense that there are enough people already in the DNC who, if they're listening or were listening, would know that everything you and I are talking about is true. And they have to decide. You know, a lot of times people are afraid of change. But what the Democrats should be afraid of now is not changing. The only thing the DNC has to worry about now is not changing. We have to change. And I think now what we have to do, if you know people in the DNC, You know, I always felt like I was looked at like I was fringe. No, they're fringe. They're fringe. They're the people who are running this 1995 playbook, which is so little power sharing, so little diversification and money to states. What is this country if not the 50 states and 7 territories?
Yeah.
Why should the power be held just here on K Street? That's beyond dysfunctional. That's malfunctional. So some people in the DNC, I think, are willing to wake up to that. A lot of what I sense is that there's some people in the DNC, maybe we can build a bridge. No, we actually, at this point, it's will there be enough people in the DNC to say enough is enough?
Yeah, and, you know, let me ask you about Trump as a candidate. He ran a campaign for 8 years. Should we now be looking for candidates for president in 2028 and start promoting them and start running them now rather than wait to the primary? Or, I mean, some countries have elections that are 4 weeks long. You know, but should we start working now to get a candidate out there?
The establishment elite is already doing that. They're already using the legacy media to tout Whitmer and Pritzker, who I like, by the way, and Newsom and so forth. They're already doing that. What I would want to do as chairman of the DNC is to create a situation where whoever was running, whether it was one of them or somebody we haven't even thought of or heard of, would have a fair shot. You see, that's what I learned as a candidate. That's what matters. You know, people, sometimes I felt like people would say, who let you in here? And I would feel like James Madison. The DNC should not be the gatekeeper that they are. So it's what we should do is stand on democracy. The role of the party should be to facilitate democracy, not engineer it or manipulate it. So it's not, you know, you and I grew up at a time, the role of the party is to stand in the background. And then the people decide, and then the party steps in at that point. That's clean. That's ethical. Otherwise, you're basically actualizing everything that George Washington warned us about.
Yes.
You know, he warned us in his farewell address about parties becoming factions of men more loyal to their party than to their country. It is to the detriment of American democracy that the DNC has been so malfunctional. Once again, I didn't say dysfunctional. I said malfunctional. This is bad for our country. So this is serious stuff. And I think it's a lot of people right now, and this is good news. This is not bad news. People are not apathetic, but people are thinking. People are processing. And people would say to me on the campaign trail, I remember one young woman, and she said to me, where do you find hope? Because we were talking about all these systems being sewn up the way they are. She said, where do you find hope? And I walked over to her, and I pointed to her forehead. That's where I find hope. We're thinking this through. You know, you said earlier, you said something about how we have to tell the truth even if we don't win. How about we have to tell the truth knowing that it's going to win at some point? We can't just dwell in this permanent category. Well, we're truth tellers, and maybe the message will get out. We don't have time for that. The left needs a spine. You and I both remember a time when the left had a spine. We need a spine. We're going to win. Whether in this case, whether it would be me or not, is not that relevant because no one person is indispensable. But the win is in doing it, and the win is in creating the portal that only truth can open up. So that if not this time, someone carrying such a message as this will win next time. And that of itself is a win. And that takes to me, that takes things beyond just telling the truth. It's standing on the truth. It's insisting on the truth because it is the only survivable option for American democracy.
Well, Marianne Williamson, we're out of time now, and that's a perfect place to end. Thank you so much for being on the show. I wish you all the best of luck as DNC chair, and you're welcome back on the show anytime to talk about your vision, because I think your vision is an important One for America, and that we all need to embrace it and consider it. And I think you're such an important voice. And so we end our show with a song, which we dedicate always to the to our guests. And tonight I could think of no other song for you, Marianne Williamson, than the Beatles, All You Need Is Love. And so this goes out to all those people like Marianne, who believed that love is stronger than hate, that truth will prevail over lies, and that we are, in fact, our brother's keeper. So thank you, Marianne Williamson, for all you do.
Thank you, Michael. I love you. Thank you for having me on.
Love you, too. Okay, bye. Thanks. Cheers to the Beatles. We'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.